I'm Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi.
It's part three.
It's part three. It's year two.
It is. It's year two. It's officially year two, you guys.
It is. It's About Time for True Crime.
It is.
Your favorite true crime podcast where both of us have what? Degrees. Hooray.
And we what? Work in the field. And we what? Live, breathe, and eat this shit, apparently.
Yes, and then we do it for fun on the side after all that.
Correct.
So, hey.
So here we are.
It's so nice to have you here. Welcome or welcome back.
And we're 2 years old now.
We are officially in our terrible twos.
Yay!
Yay! Tantrums galore.
Great. Woo!
Although, I will say, for the most part, I think we've gotten better over the last 2 years.
Dear God, I hope so.
The feedback has been both good and interesting to get.
That it is. There is something very odd about not being super extroverted people in our day-to-day lives. Pretty even keel, go with the flow, have our core group of people that we choose to live our lives with, but we're not exactly like the first to sign up for karaoke and like at the bar every night. Like, that's not, I am like in my fat pants when I get home from work kind of gal. And so putting yourself out there in this way is very odd, and it opens you up to a lot of love and support, and it opens you up to a lot of the opposite of that.
A lot of commentary.
Some people will tune into like one thing that's very old and they're like, well, I hate it and I hate you. And you're like thank
kisses.
You, thank you so much for your time.
It is really weird.
And for feeling the need to say that. Because a lot of people have visceral reactions. They like really want to say negative things.
Yes.
But nobody wants to say nice things. People really love saying mean things.
No one gets wowed in a good way into writing an impromptu review.
No.
People do get wowed in a bad way into doing that. And luckily we don't have many. We have a lot of really positive feedback and a lot of really great supporters. But it is a very interesting thing to reflect on and to take in and note of all of the commentary, because really, Allie and I aren't joking. Like, it is just us in her kitchen. Like, we are just talking like normal.
That's it.
Then also, hey, internet, you're here too.
So yes, and then the table just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And
which we love. We are so grateful for.
Oh, we are over the moon. We wouldn't be doing this if we weren't over the moon for that part of it. And I mean, I think there's just as much to learn and take away from like constructive criticism.
Oh, yeah.
I think the way I operate is like, I don't leave bad reviews. I might send like an email or like a hey as like a something like I correct in private and I praise in public.
Yep.
Is my like go-to, I guess. So I'm not saying that that's how that has to be. That's not what I mean. But I'm saying like, it is so odd to me that someone's like, I listened to one thing one time and like we get this like nasty comment or email or something where it's just like, I listened to 10 minutes and I didn't like that you said the town name wrong.
Yeah. And I'm like, listen, babe, I'm from the Midwest.
And I'm like, okay, but I looked up local news coverage and that's how they said it. Like, I looked up how locals said it and that's how it was said. So I'm sorry if you are also a local who says it differently.
Yes.
Like, I cannot please everybody. Things like that where it's just like, ma'am, you got a lot of free time.
I would love to swap shoes for the time, at least
to have some. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be that upset though.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
We're
for
not
the time
we're not
at
that
least.
Easily we're not that easily like rocked.
No, Allie and I, we do look at every single review, we look at every comment, we giggle and share them back and forth, and either we're like, yay, oh my gosh, another good human in our corner, or we're like, haha, what?
Well, I don't mean that like I don't want to focus on the bad, because it's like maybe happened twice. And we're very fortunate now that I say it right. It's going to be like this outpouring.
No, we are very fortunate. We have such a delightful corner of the internet. It is just an interesting time to reflect. Like, it's been 2 years. We've done 136 or so of these, maybe 35.
This is going to be, what, 134, I think? And then we have some bonus episodes, some bloopies, some
so we've
some
done
fun stuff.
Quite a few.
Call it 140.
Yeah. And
I don't even want to go back to listen to like the first 50.
No, I'm too afraid, to be honest with you. I'm too scared. So if you've heard us from then and you stuck in, thank you, because I very clearly learned how to work Adobe Audition in the middle of all of that And we learned how to format a podcast that is not just a conversation in the middle of all of that.
Yes, I'd like to say we've aged like fine wine, where we've gotten better over time.
So true. And no mold.
And we hope to continue to just do that. Just we learn and grow. We're going to tweak things, change our mind, change our opinions.
Yeah.
Learn and grow. People. That's literally just the point. So we love getting to do it. And I think it's like almost... It's kind of like a little time capsule.
Yes.
Where we could go back in 10, 15 years and listen to this. And, oh, God, my kids someday, maybe. I don't know. You're going to be like, Mom.
You're going to be like, sorry.
But not. Just the what current events. Like, for example, it's a little late now that this is coming out, but Gypsy Rose is pregnant.
Yes, she is.
I called it. Just saying.
You did. You really did.
I thought
you
it was
said gonna, by the end of the year.
I did think it would be her husband's child. So,
womp womp.
But, you know, do I get like half a point for that at least?
You get a full point, babe.
That's right. I didn't call dibs on also the DNA of the
kid.
Yeah,
you weren't like, she's going to be pregnant. Also, it's going to be his. Also, it was in the kitchen with the candle holder stick.
I know. There's so many things about her that I know we like bring it up, but like she's everywhere you look. And anytime anybody goes true crime news, like I think... Some people who were never into it before are like, she's their introduction now.
Yes.
Because of the show and because she was released. And now everywhere you look, it's like her name and everything. She is just a person. She's a person that made a lot of poor decisions, but she was also traumatized and abused. And so they're like, do you think she's an offender or a victim? I'm like, she is both. Why is it either or?
This is not mutually exclusive territory.
No. And, you know, she's... going into this next chapter of her life, and I honestly have not watched the show. I have not followed that piece of it, of like what happened with her marriage or everything, except the like posts that I've seen from like news little like blips of it or whatever. Yeah,
the clickbait.
It's pretty much what it is.
Yeah,
but I know that she's like not with her hubby anymore or whatever, but like all these memes are coming out where like one said, oh, what was it? It was like her kid has an opportunity to do something fucking wild here.
Yes.
And I'm like, don't say it. Like, that's just, come on, man. Like, I, yes.
But the memes have been insane. That being said, that is a human that will be coming to this world. And hopefully they are in a better spot than their mom was, which I have no doubt she will attempt to do things better than her parents did, because I think that's what every parent does. But I do think it's particularly funny that the same day that news broke, I had three different people text me within an hour, like, did you hear?
I texted you. I was just like, girl.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, what a world that we're in.
Yeah, we got some DMs of people being like, did you see that? Like, sending us the news stuff, and I'm like, oh, you know, I run the Instagram page. I was like, oh my God.
Yes. I love it.
You know.
What a time.
What a time in this world.
What a time in this world to exist, you know? And also with you.
And also with you.
I am really excited, though, for today's case. But before we hop into it, we did just have one last little roundup on our anniversary. And this is a call to action.
Happy anniversary, you guys.
Aw, romantic. We love you. But for our 2 year, much like our 1 year, we are considering doing a wee giveaway or fun event, perhaps a merch drop. That being said, we are not entirely sold on a design and or concept yet. So we would love for you, dear listener, to... tell us either below in the Q&A, to DM us on Instagram, to email us. Let us know what you want. We will roundtable. And by that, I mean Allie and I will probably text. And then we'll decide. And we'll let you all know what we're doing. But we're so excited. And we're so excited you're here.
Yeah. What do you guys want? What would you wear if you would wear anything? What seems most practical? We also have stickers that I feel like we could pick like 5 people to mail them. And
oh, yeah.
We could do something fun like that. But we'll talk more about that maybe in a week or so.
And don't dream so big. It's like a blip and you want skywriting, because we don't have the funds for that. But dream big. Let us know what you'd want. Like, tell us, and we can look at it.
Yeah. So just let us know. That's all. We're just going to like leave you with that.
But Now we're hopping into part three of Al Capone.
Part three, final part.
Final part. Final part of our three-part series.
The final chapter.
And I'm just going to hop right into it. So today we are going to complete our series on Al Capone. We're going to go through the investigation of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the fall of Al Capone, his time incarcerated, including Alcatraz, baby,
ooh,
and his eventual end of life. As always, a few of my sources will always be named at the top, but you can see the long and extensive list in our Google Drive file, which will always be linked below, because this case, if I remember correctly, has 3 pages of sources.
Oh, my.
So we can't fit that down below.
Well, they don't give us enough characters in the description box, but
no, it's a lot more than 4,000.
We told you when we research,
we go
deep down.
So I did just want to do a little shout out to the ones that I got a lot out of for today's episode. So that would be history.com, FBI.gov. And I got a ton of help from the Unsolved Murders episodes on the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which I believe was 163 and 164. Again, they're linked. But I also wanted to issue a trigger warning for some pretty awful descriptions from the massacre. We'll talk forensics, but we'll also be talking about prison culture and failing health, two topics that have the range of either not impacting people at all or perhaps being incredibly overwhelmingly triggering. So if you need to skip, please do that. But otherwise, we'll see you next week or we'll see you in a few. Now, we left off last week with 4 men leaving the carriage warehouse in Lincoln Park after the massacre took place on February 14th, 1929. While 7 men lie inside, there are 2 men dressed as officers taking 2 other civilian-dressed men to what appear to be undercover police sedans, a black Peerless and a black Cadillac, both of which were typically seen to be undercover police cars at the time.
Which makes sense.
It's about 10:30 a.m. on Valentine's Day, and it's cold. The public is worried after hearing so many shots, but seeing the 2 officers walk away with 2 men make them feel a little bit better about the scene being secured. Except the men in the uniform come and go, and there's a dog yapping incessantly. This dog has a big yappetite, if you will. Okay. Which, as an incessant yapper, I can relate to.
Oh.
But these people couldn't. A brave man decides to go see the puppy, who we learn later is unharmed, which is great, okay, but also belonged to one of the mechanics that was inside.
No.
He goes in and he ends up seeing what happened in this warehouse. And this man is aghast to see 6 dead men on the floor and 1 man army crawling for his life, barely making it anywhere.
Oh.
This man is Frank Gusenberg and was barely clinging to life when the stranger found him. Obviously, this kind stranger freaked out and called 911, as he should. It's possible that this was the dramatic retelling in Unsolved Murders, but they did seem to allude that at this point, many people started calling 911 after hearing all of the shots, which, like, I think would make sense.
I mean, I would hope so. I hope that that's not so common that you're like, meh.
I'll just let it go.
Or someone else will.
Right? But regardless, Frank was able to be picked up and taken to the hospital. He had 14 bullets in his body and died 3 hours later.
Oh, so he just suffered. That's awful.
He still refused to give any information beyond 1 line. It was the cops.
Oh.
Frank wouldn't even confirm if the men were lined up in a row while they were shot. He said absolutely nothing else. He wouldn't say what happened. He wouldn't say how it happened, just that it was the cops.
He refused to speak or he couldn't speak?
Refused, because he could tell them that it was the cops.
Interesting. Okay.
The investigators continued to ask other questions with no varying or new answers from Frank before he died. And the detectives surely were interested in following up on every lead they got, but this didn't make sense to them. One, if it was a police officer, why didn't the 2 men that were taken end up in custody somewhere? They had called every pre-holding courthouse, jail, or temporary custody area in the city to no avail. There were also no records of the police being called prior, which would, of course, be noted under best practices. Mm-hmm. Was that the practice in 1929? I don't know, but I would assume, because you kind of got to keep track of who's where. But two, why would a police officer do this? Of course there were crooked police, but the thing about a crooked cop was the same thing about Al in that they wanted money, not allegiance. So killing anyone limits the income stream for them, much less seven from one gang, and that puts you on a side, which would limit you from any income from the other gangs.
Yes.
Which means you're a pretty bad gold digger.
Yeah.
You know?
You fucked up.
So it just didn't make sense for it to be a cop, even though that's the only information they had. But because also all of the public had seen the cops, they were the number one suspect for a long time. Further, as we briefly touched on earlier, everyone and their mother had a different investigation going. This is not the time of communication and shared policing and one big happy family as long as we get the guy. This is the time of I want to be the one to do it. Fuck you.
Yeah, and I'll try to mess you up so that I can get ahead.
Right. And the cops wanted to solve it in Chicago, but then the state police wanted to solve it, and then the courts and prosecutors wanted to solve it, and then, oh, journalists got in on it too. Newspapers are reporting whatever they hear, whether or not it's true. And at the time, that meant police. They were the number one suspect, and that's what was in the paper, and that's what everybody read. Police are investigating witnesses, but people aren't too into cooperating because they're terrified. And if you were at all neutral about this in the day, it was probably knowing the gangs provided alcohol, and so you might not want to reveal to a cop in a time where consumption is illegal that you are content with the gangs.
Yes.
So this obviously proved very unfruitful as an investigation. Police were then looking for new witnesses and descriptions. They ended up at the hotel across the street from the carriage house, and the owner recounted renting two rooms to quote-unquote nicely dressed men for the day.
It's always nicely dressed men.
They're always so nicely dressed. They're just poorly behaved.
I would be kind of worse, though, if they were like, they just dress like shit.
Yep.
All the time. They come in just nasty. Just nasty.
He's got a mustard stain on his sweatpants.
Just nasty.
B.O. stains down to his flank.
Ew. That just sounds worse.
Anyway. So apparently these two men rented two rooms for the day, except they only eventually hung out in one and canceled the second room, claiming they couldn't afford it, which was interesting. But witnesses had no alleged descriptions, although two people did think they saw a man named Harry Keywell. He was known in the area as he was a contract killer for the Purple Gang that was out of Detroit. But the police did find Harry Keywell. He was in Detroit, but allegedly he had an alibi that was so airtight it couldn't have been him. What that alibi was, we don't know. It's lost in time, it wasn't written down, but they were convinced and they moved on.
Okay.
Then, of course, as more ideas come out and more secrecy happens, the entire city is outraged. They are sick of the violence and they're freaking scared. Like what used to be one or two offs max with the gangs was always the gang members included. And it was never more than that. On the rare event that even in the gangs there were three people killed off, that was front page news easy. But now there are seven people and including innocent bystanders involved. And over things that, as far as they could tell, were not getting them more alcohol. So now there is no pull to this allegiance, and there's just more and more reasons that people are getting outraged, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous for everyone now, not just the people trying to sell it to you. So every single agency wants to be, quote-unquote, the one who finds the answers.
Oh my God, egos, put them away.
They want to be the ones who get justice. They want to win the public over with their efficiency and proficiency. But because of this here and in so many other fucking cases, they would not work with other agencies, which hurts both their what? Efficiency and proficiency.
Yep.
If prosecutors found something, the detectives wouldn't know. And if journalists found something, prosecutors wouldn't know. It was just a clusterfuck of an investigation. But they're also all really bad at providing adequate expectations and would further hurt their relationship with the public by promising the case would be solved in hours or a day or by such and such date, even though they had no fucking leads. Who stole the cookie from the cookie jar? Could it be who you, not me? Oh, okay, it's solved by this afternoon.
Great.
Like, what the... What are you going to do with that? And then people are like, oh, it's supposed to be solved this afternoon. And you're like, we still do not know who stole the cookie from the cookie jar.
Yes, but as soon as we know that,
It's all over for you bitches.
It'll be great.
But of course, that's not what happened. And people are getting angrier and they're getting more fed up and more stressed out because now there's someone out there who's committing massacres without any retribution.
Yes.
But there's someone who's willing to help. There's a coroner's office and the coroner actually gets involved. His name is Dr. Haman Bundesen, and he was the coroner and actually refused to get involved in any of the payouts. He considered himself very clean and was very prideful on that. Like, he would not take a payout. He wouldn't do any of that. Because of it, he thought he was the right man for this job. And he, unlike other agencies or media at the time, refused to put out theories or suspects without actually thoroughly investigating. Revolutionary. It's never been done before.
Okay.
Dr. Bundesen puts together a panel of other people and well-respected men in the area that were also known to refuse buyouts and prided themselves on their quote-unquote cleanliness in that realm.
Okay.
So Dr. Bundesen was actually really well-loved in Chicago because he personally did a lot of research and released a lot of resources to help pregnant women decrease infant mortality rate by reviewing science around breastfeeding and child-rearing methods.
Okay.
So he had some fans. People were like, okay, we trust you.
That's positive.
Now, this panel that Coroner Bundesen put together included six highly esteemed people, four of which were lawyers and two were businessmen. They put their heads together until someone finally came up with the connection or the idea to connect to Major Calvin Goddard. Who? Mm-hmm. The man who fully developed forensic ballistics.
Like, okay, that's pretty fancy.
The father of, birthed from him and his DNA. There's an ultrasound of him and a little gun extraction mark.
Aww.
Congrats. It's a forensic science.
There's a lot of firsts and like OGs in this.
Yes. Actually, fun fact, it was the president of Colgate who was both a friend of Dr. Bundesen's and offered the suggestion to bring out Goddard. But without the funds, Bundesen was like, brother, it's the fucking Great Depression. How are we going to get this man here and feed him and keep him alive and pay him for his time? But it's the president of Colgate.
You can make it work.
Yeah, don't worry about it. I got it. On me.
I can afford it. Thank you.
Star witness on me, on the house, okay?
And he'll get some toothpaste.
Yes, exactly.
For his kids.
Squeaky clean.
There you go.
All right. Yeah. So, with the generosity of the president of Colgate and the availability and willingness of Goddard, the coroner's panel actually was able to bring him out and started doing real ballistics with him. First, he explained what he did. So, what we explained a few episodes ago, actually, was about the extraction marks and their fingerprint-esque qualities for guns and bullets.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, whenever a bullet goes through the barrel of a gun, there's a mark on it called the extraction mark, and that's different for every single gun. It's like a little fingerprint. And that can tell you if bullets were shot from the same gun, and if you have the right gun that match the extraction marks on the bullets. Makes sense to me. They were able to determine that from the bullets they had collected from the massacre, there were three separate guns used. Two Tommy guns and a pistol or a shotgun, I believe. Ultimately, this is the first time they can confirm it wasn't a legit police officer involved because they didn't have the machine guns and the other gun didn't match the make or model of the police guns at the time.
Okay, so we can finally rule that out.
Correct.
Officially.
So then, there's more work to do. A few more days go by, and come February 21st, a garage at 1723 North Wood Street blows up and bursts into flames.
Ooh.
The police entered and saw a burnt-out car husk, but noted that it was a 27 Cadillac touring car, the exact make and model that most detective cars were at the time. Plus, there was a jerry-rigged siren on top and included a hacksaw and other tools to take a car apart nearby. The police determined that someone was trying to take it apart and must have hit a gas line where it then burst into flames.
Mm-hmm.
From witnesses, they hear of a man running outside who was burnt into a hospital, but he had left unexpectedly before the police arrived after the car incident. So police now believe the man involved in the car was also involved in the shooting because the car was the same kind. He was trying to take it apart and obviously dispose of it. And then when he went to seek medical attention, He must have remembered that you might be able to be found here, and he left.
A lead. Yay.
Hooray. And they believed now, specifically, that whoever committed the offense of the massacre was trying to make themselves look more legit, like police officers, because they had seen how the car had been altered.
Yes. Switched up to look. Okay.
It leads them to a man named Frank Dodgers, who was in the only Northside gang that had been allied with Al Capone.
Okay.
This gang, because
he was Southside.
Yes.
So he had only one connection.
Ally in the North. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that was the gang that they ran into.
Okay.
And this gang operated out of the Citrus Cafe. And so the police went there, but oddly enough, it actually had recently closed. Yeah, they had kind of turned it into a shooting practice range.
Oh?
Yeah.
I hate when that happens to my favorite cafe.
I was like, I just wanted a fucking omelet, okay?
Damn. You think you know a place.
But when they connected the Citrus Cafe to the gang and they went after the leader, they find Claude Maddox, who led the gang. And the other part of it, though, was that Claude was incarcerated and definitely not their guy.
Claude.
Well, he didn't have any of those take-home visits that a lot of people do.
Yeah, those the furlough?
Correct.
You can get one of those?
No, he did not get the Bundy package, so...
But he'd still been naughty. Come on, guy.
Correct. But pretty damn shortly after, around February 27th, another explosion.
Okay, except that's kind of freaky, though. I would, like, if I were just your average guy living around there, I'd be like, what in the world is going on?
I think
on?
I'm gonna move.
I don't think I like Chicago that much anymore.
Oh, please. It didn't start with this. Al was blowing up all sorts of speakeasies.
Well.
All over the place. Anyway, there was another explosion in Maywood. And this time it was another car, interestingly enough. This one had stolen plates from a police department. And there was a notebook in the car from one of the men at the scene. Plus, the guns that were used were in the car.
That helps.
But when the police got there, it was obvious that this was an attempt to cover things up and destroy evidence. But whoever did it made a mistake and put the bomb under the hood. And this is way back in the 20s when cars were made out of actual metal. So it didn't explode. It just did a little damage to the engine and the hood, and everything else was fucking fine.
Yep.
But with this, they could also trace the ownership. And this led them back to a man named Jack McGurn. He was nicknamed Machine Gun Jack McGurn. So that should tell you something. And they followed their little leads to him.
Yes.
And they bust in on him at a hotel. But they probably should have knocked because he was enjoying the pleasure of a woman's company.
Ooh, okay.
They said, whoa, put some clothes on that kid. You're under arrest.
Oh, no.
I don't think they said he was under arrest, but they did question him. And they were like,
He's like, I'm busy, you see?
We got some questions. And he had an alibi. He was doing that same dirty deed done dirt cheap with the same woman in the same hotel.
For the same price.
Exactly. Her name? Lois Rolfe. She was a showgirl. A flapper, you see?
Mm.
But the two had checked into their hotel room like 2 weeks prior to the shooting, so it couldn't have been them.
2 weeks.
This is suspicious to police, and while I don't believe he gets charged right away, he does soon so that the police can, quote-unquote, keep their promise of solving the case. Okay. Which is great evidence to go on.
Okay.
However, this gives him time to prep. Obviously, they were there, and he could probably tell that they weren't fucking around, you know?
Yes.
But Machine Gun Jack McGurn is charged with some interesting charges. He must have made bail because he found out what they were and was able to have some workarounds. He had been charged with a few different things, including white slavery.
Oh.
Which we'll talk about, because at the time, this was a crime that had been passed to help combat forced prostitution. But the law was written so poorly and so vaguely that quite literally any man who even crossed a state border with an unmarried woman could be charged with it.
Whoa.
Yep. So if your brother takes a sister to another state, that could technically be white slavery under the grounds of this law because it was so vague.
That's the issue when you pass laws before you read them.
Before you read them or before you consider any of the ways that this could accomplish something besides the initial point of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not helpful.
No.
But Jack takes this moment. He goes, okay, Lois, you've been waiting for it. I've been waiting for it. Let's get hitched.
Oh, okay.
And they do, because this does two things for Jack. First, it pretty much disregards the entire white slavery charge.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that at the time she was unmarried, she is now his wife. And so, well, that can't be forced prostitution. That's your wife. She belongs to you. She's property. Because why would she be a woman in her own right?
Yes.
But also, it gave an advantage in that she does not have to testify against him.
Yeah, there it is.
There it is.
Ding, ding, ding.
So it drops one charge and it pretty much secures his alibi for the other.
Yes.
Which means he does not get convicted.
Hmm.
They go through these trials and everyone's theory ends up being that Al Capone had hired Claude Maddox, the leader of this gang, and Jack McGurn. They then outsourced to the American Boys gang and the circus gangs, who I believe the circus gang runs out of the Citrus Cafe. It's a lot of C words.
Oh, I just want to be there.
They later...
Circus and Citrus and American Boy doll and American Girl doll and all... Come on, man.
And who is the little puppy? Coconut?
Just let me sit with like a little milkshake and I just want to listen. I don't have to talk to anybody. I just want to be there.
This American Girl doll wants to go undercover in a speakeasy.
Yeah. Get arrested.
Ooh.
And I would.
Yeah. You don't have good luck.
No, it'd be my luck. Nope.
No. Neither do I, though. So they later get a lot more information from a man named Brian Bolton, who was the man that ended up driving the Cadillac in the massacre.
Mm.
While Brian did not necessarily tell any of the helpful police, he told the FBI, except the FBI had no real jurisdiction in a crime that happened in a state, not over state borders, and was not a federal offense.
Awesome.
They did not want to talk to state police. And the only other time that they had found out, it was so much time had passed that they didn't really care anymore. They had bigger, more pressing things.
Okay.
Further, I don't know if it's Brian Bolton's wife or if there was another man involved whose wife wrote her tell-all of being married to a gangster, but it included a very detailed account of this. So we have lots of information on what happened. We just don't have anything officially written down.
Mm.
If you want to find out more specifics, like including all of the very interesting and detailed account of who was involved, how they got the ballistics figured out, and how they finished this investigation, you should go ahead and listen to that Unsolved Murders podcast on it, because they do like a full deep dive. They've got all of the names, all of the people, the places, the things. But that in and of itself was 2 hours, and baby, we didn't have time for that today. But it was during that investigation that another one was going on too. Ralph Capone, Al's brother, had been told that he was under investigation for tax fraud.
Ruh-roh.
So Ralph goes, listen, I want to compromise, okay? Because the IRS agent had come to him and been like, so you should probably pay that because they got you on some stuff, okay?
Oh, so he got a heads up, basically. He did.
So Ralph goes back and he goes, listen, I'm not a bad guy, right?
And you got a nice ass, I'm just saying.
That's a compliment, honey. He says, listen, as a compromise, I will pay you $1,000.
It's a lot of money.
It is, in the time.
Then.
So he says, I think that's fair. This is what I'll pay for all of my missed taxes. That's what I claimed on my tax income now that I am going back and claiming it because I found out that you were on my ass about it. What do you think? And this doesn't really work for him.
Yeah.
The investigators in the IRS had to go back and search through by hand 6+ different bank accounts that Ralph had used to confirm that they were Ralph's. They got his signature on the checks, and that was it, because he had a bunch of different aliases.
Yeah.
That was his whole thing. They also had to use witnesses to confirm that Ralph was the one that pulled the money out. So they could say, see, here's the person, here's the face, here's the signature, even though these 5-6 plus bank accounts have other people's names on them. But when it turned out he had been, and they were able to get him, they got him on a lot of income fraud, specifically.
I just think it's fascinating that they were even able to do that, considering there was no database where all of this was stored. Nope. This was not computerized. You had to go seek out the physical records of it.
Yeah.
Hope that there wasn't a coffee stain on it, or it didn't get smudged, or it wasn't transcribed incorrectly at all, that their handwriting was neat, that it was stamped correctly.
Yeah. It's a lot of man work.
And like the, I don't know, that just seems like a lot of hours and manpower, like just brain power needed to assess that you can't, the person looking into that can't miss a beat.
Right.
Either.
And the good and the bad thing is, I believe that Ralph was actually able to either get some sort of a plea bargain or get in and out of there without a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But it was with this case that they were able to really have the grounds to look at Al. Because of the income that Ralph claimed, they were then able to connect that to Al and say, well, he should have at least had this.
Was Al the one that they were mainly going for?
Oh, and yeah.
The brother was just how they got to him?
I believe so.
Yeah.
If not, I think they were trying to get anywhere near the Capone family that they could to see what they could get on Al.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened that both of them were really bad at doing their taxes.
Great.
Al got the same thing pretty quickly. However, they charged Al with tax evasion, not fraud, because he, unlike Ralph, didn't go back and say, hey, here was my income for these years. He just said, no, I got a nice check, honey, and it's not going to your ass. And that's a
compliment. Oh, no.
Al.
So, damn it, Al.
They gave him a ridiculous plea bargain, something like a few $1 million in today's money to be paid over 2 years if he pled guilty, which Al has, as noted, over like $1 billion coming in, probably annually at this point in today's money. So
that's a lot.
That's a few million is like a slap on the wrist. The difference between $1 million and $1 billion is so much greater than anybody wants to give it credit for.
I know.
But when Al said, okay, I'll take it, and pled guilty, they rescinded the plea bargain. They said, yeah, actually, we don't want to give that to you anymore.
Dang.
And Al then tried to change his plea to innocent, but it was not allowed, which was very interesting.
Okay.
So it is here that Al goes to prison. I'm not going to bore you on the actual specifics of all of this. If you are interested in that piece, you should go listen to that Mysterious Circumstances three-parter that I noted earlier, because they go into like painful detail of this is how they got Ralph and that's how they got Al. But for the sake of interest and the more exciting things to come, I'm just going to let you know that Al gets sentenced to 11 years for tax evasion and fraud.
That's
11.
That's it?
That's the biggest sentence to date in history for tax fraud.
But that's it? Yeah. I mean, for tax fraud, yes, tax fraud, I understand.
Yep.
But he killed a lot of people.
And they never got him on any of them. So this was the best they could do. They said 11 years.
Oh, no.
Which, Al has this quote. I think it's, I'm pretty sure I'm not butchering it, but if I am, I'm not looking at it. So, you know, hands up.
Mm.
But he says something like, you can't get legal taxes from illegal money. So like, he didn't claim it because he got the money illegally. And how can you get a legal tax off illegally made money?
I mean,
which does make sense.
Well, yeah, because then he'd have to admit to making a profit illegally, which he's not going to do.
No.
So no, I'm not going to pay taxes on that. And how do you get
taxed on something that is
illegal? Because then the government has to admit to, yeah, no.
Because then isn't that taxation illegal?
Yeah, because you're...
Because the money isn't
clean. And you're also acknowledging that it's happening. So are you condoning it?
Yeah, exactly. So it's just interesting. Obviously, that didn't work. He still got sentenced.
Yes.
And yes, 11 years is a stupid long time for tax fraud, but it is very close to nothing when you've ordered the hits of estimated around 300 people.
Mm.
But on top of this, Al was sentenced to pay $215,000 in back pay taxes with 50% interest and almost $8,000 in legal and court fees, and he was fined $50,000. Kids, do not fuck with the IRS.
Nope.
It is worth paying them the money for your peace of mind and knowing that you don't have to, what is that, pay about $300,000?
Yeah, just best to.
And that's the 1920s money.
Ugh.
Yeah. Not it.
Or be work your 9-to-5, work a real job.
Work a real job, put it on the books.
Don't hurt people.
And don't go to prison.
Don't do that. I mean, just, you know.
Oh my gosh. Wait, something that did make me laugh. I think it was Ralph. They might have mentioned it about Frankie, but if they did, it would have had to been way back in the day. So I think it was Ralph.
Mm.
Ralph filed his taxes but didn't pay them.
Sir.
I did that 1 year.
Abby.
I did that 1 year. And when I did it, I obviously, like, they called me. They were like, are you going to pay these? And I was like, I did, didn't I? And they're like, no, you're stupid. You have to pay them. Like, you have to put in, like, a check or something. And I was like, you asked for my bank account. And they're like, yeah, for the refund. So anyway, that's my story as a convict. Not a convict. That's my story as a criminal.
Oh, Abby.
But I made it right. I talked to them. They're really willing to work it out with you. So there's no fucking excuse. Just pay your fucking taxes.
Damn, you snub them 50 cents and they're, where is it?
Yep. They're shaking out your pockets for your lunch money.
They are. Just gnarly.
So it's, anyway, just fucking pay your taxes, okay? It should also be noted here that Al's team, of course, did try to bribe the jury at some point, because that's what they do. He did go with a defense attorney for criminal court, which might have been a mistake, as he had been offered services by a man who did a majority, if not exclusively, tax evasion crimes.
Mm.
But he said, nah, 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 I want my guy who knows the gangs. He's a criminal defense attorney. Before the trial, they tried to bribe all these jurors to be like, you know, Al's not that bad of a guy, you see?
You see?
But the judge caught wind of it, and before the trial started, he had another judge swap juries with him. They completely blind. Just swapped them.
How?
Beats the fuck out of me.
Okay.
It's the 20s, babe.
I know, but, you know.
Actually, right now it's the 30s. I think it's 1931 when he gets sentenced. But the fact that it's 1931 makes it even worse, because now not only has the jury not been bribed, they know who Al Capone is. He's on trial for paying no tax. And he was willing to take a plea bargain that was essentially the equivalent of millions of dollars over 2 years to not be in jail. And it's the Great Fucking Depression.
Mm.
People do not have any empathy for Al. Yeah. They're like, I sold my kid.
Oh.
Because I couldn't afford to feed him or the other ones. So this will feed us for a month.
Oh.
I don't care about your taxes.
Can you guys hear this storm? We are getting such a spooky-ooky storm right now.
It's so true. It was a dark and stormy night. Boom, boom, crack, you know?
It does feel like it, though. Anyway.
So, again, this is the longest sentence anybody has ever seen for tax fraud, still to date. So, Al gets incarcerated.
Oh.
First, he serves some time in Cook County Jail, which, like, represent Cook County, I guess. Let's fucking go, okay. I guess. Before being moved to a penitentiary in Ohio. And if you guys ever want, like, a fun CJ short on the differences between incarceration facilities, like prisons or jails or penitentiaries, let us know. We are nerds and love to talk about it. So we would.
I also, we've been watching trash TV lately. My soon-to-be husband and I. And we've been watching 60 Days In, like, ugh, A&E's.
I
call it trash. It's reality TV. You know, it's got that kind of, like, spin on it. So there's, like, all the interviews and everything. But they did one in Cook County. And I don't know if it's that Cook County, because there's, like, probably hundreds of Cook counties.
It's probably that one.
But I think it is.
It's got Chicago prisons.
Yeah.
It's probably that Cook County.
So yeah, so it's 60 days. Civilians go into jails and evaluate the jails, but it's also like they could have done it a better way. This was just a really cool way for a TV show.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's fun.
I like the first few seasons. I'm losing it when we get to the COVID era stuff. I'm like, I lived that. I don't need to watch that.
Yeah, that's rough. Especially working in it at that time, like, you know, all of the shit.
Yeah, that's like the TV shows lose me when they do a COVID segment because we lived it for so like years. I don't want to watch it again.
Beignet done that, you know?
Yeah, no. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, so Al gets to this penitentiary in Ohio and he ends up, of course, bribing off the guards. And he gets like a cozy little setup. They bring in his mattress from home.
Are you serious?
He's got fancy pajamas.
His wife and Sonny are just sleeping on the floor now.
I don't think things were that dire. He did not have to pay back the $2 million-ish.
But still.
Yeah.
It's just the thought of like, she's like, where are all the bedding's on the floor, on the ground? She's like, just the mattress. What? Just the box spring? She's like, excuse me.
She's like, that hurts my back. So, obviously, this was not particularly good. Fuck a bag.
Oh my god. Holy shit.
That was really loud. All right, you guys, sorry if I squeal at all. It's really loud thunder and lightning here.
The storm is right over us. We just shit our pants. It was really loud.
Yes. Full Al Capone. Shit my pants.
Oh god. That was...
Sorry, too soon for that joke in this episode, but...
No, I don't get it, but I will, apparently.
I guess. So...
Ooh, freaky.
You're wondering. This did get found out by the warden, and normally Al can sort of bribe his way wherever, but because this was a federal offense, and because people were up every warden's butt who had Al Capone in their facility, this did not last. He said, "Nay, nay, you shan't be." So instead, they send him to Alcatraz, which we'll talk about. Of course, in Ohio and the Midwest, Al is a very big, huge household name. And it's said he became a national celebrity, which I agree with for the most part. However, if you look at his travels, like the places that he frequents, he doesn't go very far west. He tends to bounce back and forth between Michigan, Illinois, and the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But... the hopes of sending Al to Alcatraz was to get him away, A, from the huge reputation, but also, B, to a place that's more locked down.
Yeah, can't really get further away than that.
No. And Alcatraz, which I've been to, cool.
Jealous.
Maybe I'll see if I can find a photo of that trip, was a small island off of San Francisco in California. It's been used as many different things, including a native reservation, a military base, and other uses around its time as a penitentiary. The goal of Alcatraz being this penitentiary was twofold. One, it was hard to escape. If you got out of the building, you still had to get off of the island through the bay and to the country without being spotted or caught by guards who lived on the island. Is it impossible? No. A few guys did get to a boat. Did they ever hear about them getting to the mainland? No. Two, it was sort of a mental prison for the inmates as well. The maddening nature of being able to see life go on around you without any ability to be in it really adds. So it's a very interesting thing because if you ever get the chance to go, and I don't know if they're still doing tours now, it was kind of like really falling apart. And I heard for a moment they might be closing it for that purpose.
Oh.
But if you ever do get the chance to go or even just go visit the island, you can see it. You can see San Francisco. You can see people walking around the streets. You can see them driving. You can see life go on and you can have zero impact on it anyway.
Yeah. And you can be just out of touch enough and far enough away that people who did get out, they're like, sure, you might have even made it beyond the cell, beyond the building, beyond the fence. You might have made it to the water, but you weren't going to make it to shore.
Yeah, the chances of anybody getting through a cell, through the building, through the island, to the bay, and then still getting to California, and still finding a place to hide after all of that time and effort.
Yeah, but even surviving the swim.
Yeah.
If you, like...
And that's if you had swim.
Yeah, how are you going to do that?
So It is a feat to get off of Alcatraz. And it's not completely undone, but it was marketed as inescapable.
Wow.
Which, statistically, it pretty much was. So Al goes to Alcatraz, where he's known only as Prisoner 85. Capone initially, I think, tried to do some good with this.
I bet he'd prefer Scarface at this point.
No, I think he still prefers Snorky.
Oh.
But I think Al tries to do some good. Initially, he checked out self-help books like Life Begins at 40, as well as books about self-improvement, bettering his English, gardening, and even music appreciation. But regrettably, I'm not sure how much they helped or how long he was able to continue to do this. See, some time ago, we talked about Al getting syphilis. He had contracted it in his late teens or early 20s, but being afraid of needles, he never got the only treatment that was available for it. And it was around this time that he starts displaying symptoms of neurosyphilis, which at the time was called syphilis of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to review with you quickly what syphilis does to a person. So if you need a trigger warning for diseases and symptoms, have any hypochondriac tendencies,
ooh,
maybe skip this part. According to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Strokes and PBS, syphilis is a sexually transmitted disease that impacts the body in three phases. The first is a painless sore or canker, which is typically seen on the genitals from the transmission, but anywhere from like 3 to 90 days after exposure. I guess you could probably also see this on someone's mouth or hands, depending on the circumstance of which it was transferred.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's like 3 to 90 days after you have contact.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second phase is an itchy, nasty rash and happens once the canker or the sore clears up. And this tends to be 4 to 10 weeks after exposure. Usually, any and all symptoms after this rash disappear.
Oh, okay.
You think it's gone dormant. You have no other symptoms after this rash.
So you think you're fine?
Probably.
You're not fine.
Correct. And by the time you get the third stage, where the symptoms have spread, it's often too late to do much about it. This third stage is when the disease bonds to other organs like the heart, lungs, and brain. Cardiovascular syphilis, when it attaches primarily to the heart, can lead to congestive heart failure, myocardial inflammation, and even sudden death. When syphilis attaches to your lungs, you can have symptoms such as a cough, coughing up blood, difficulty breathing, and chest pain. But neurosyphilis, which Al had, has many different potential symptoms and presentations as it progresses. Sometimes it's asymptomatic, but it also seems to be progressive. You can go from meningeal neurosyphilitis, which gives you stiffness in your shoulders and back. You can have nausea or vomiting, and sometimes even hearing or vision impairment, to what I believe is pronounced meningovascular neurosyphilitis. If you look it up, let me know if I'm wrong.
Say that 5 times fast.
No, I can barely say it once. But this phase of neurosyphilis can lead to strokes. And then there's general paresis, which includes personality or mood changes. And finally, there's tabes dorsalis, which includes pain in limbs and abdomen, poor gait, impaired balance, failure of muscle coordination, and even bladder or other organ failure.
Oof.
Al had contracted syphilis at least 10 years or so prior to being incarcerated. During his time at Alcatraz, Al's syphilis was progressing. I mean, it was the whole time, but he didn't have symptoms. He was between stage 2 and stage 3. However, this did not stop him from having a good time while he was in prison.
Oh.
Al's syphilis was progressing, sure, but he wanted to listen to music. He wanted to play music. He lobbied for a full fucking year to have the warden let them have, like, a band. And he did.
And they did.
They let him. They said, listen, you can't practice for more than 20 minutes a day, but you can do it.
Oh, my.
So Al picks the banjo, which is just so funny to
Al
think about.
Al Capone playing the banjo?
Yup. From the biography Capone by Lawrence Bergreen, Capone chose the banjo, and Bergreen writes, He had not previously played this or any other instrument, nor is there any evidence that he was able to read music prior to jail, but he patiently familiarized himself with the rudiments of music theory and eventually was able to decipher musical notation and to pick out a few simple tunes, softly singing along.
There you go.
Al eventually swapped his banjo for either a mandolin or a mandola, depends on who tells you. They're very similar instruments, but they're different stringed instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Al got really confident and even wrote to Sonny that he could play something like 500 songs.
And Sonny was probably like, hey, could you like have just not done that and you could have been home with us? Or
you could have played me 500 songs from home.
But, okay.
Except he probably couldn't appreciate it that much.
True.
But I don't know if he could play 500 songs. I know he thought he could.
Well, that's half the battle.
Allegedly, at this same time, another inmate found scissors and tried to attack Al, only to get a mandola or a mandolin smashed right over that head.
Oh, no.
Also, something kind of cute, unfortunately, was that Al did write a song for May.
Okay.
He called it Madonna Mia, and it was a sentimental tribute to her suffering. Which I'm like, that's the fucking least you can do.
Sweet, but did it have to come when you were so fucking bored?
So bored and neurologically ill.
And dying?
In between his reading, music, working, yes, he did sweep, mop, do laundry, and dishes, Al's brain was slowly slipping. The other thing that syphilis in the brain at the time, or neurosyphilis, can impact is the central and peripheral nervous systems. For those of you who may not know, the nervous system is also heavily incorporated in mental health disorders like anxiety disorders, panic disorders, and paranoia. There are many reports of Al being increasingly paranoid, and there are reports of Al being haunted by people he's killed. They say he slowly started to see things that weren't there, forgetting where he was, and more. And yes, there were times he was lucid, but the symptoms really mimicked that of dementia. He might have even technically been diagnosed with dementia at some point, but I think that
he may have fit criteria, but exactly. Not for that reason.
Correct. This was all attributed to the neurosyphilis, but I guess if you're into the spooky ooky, he could have been haunted. I think it's possible.
Sure. But also awful. I mean, was he awful? Yes. But also, there comes a time where I think when people like lose control over like their, I don't know, their body functions and their brain and their faculties and everything like that, where they're really not them anymore. It's like no matter what they did in their life.
Yeah, it's a human.
The human aspect of it is you empathize with that part of them, even if, you know, the two of you wouldn't have necessarily have had anything to say to each other. That piece of it is what,
right,
I hope we can all agree is the most upsetting part.
Well, that's because we respect human life and decency, and I think that's important.
And just because he didn't
doesn't mean that he's not one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But he, of course, at this time had his syphilis being treated. He did not, I believe, willfully have needles put into him, but penicillin had come out. And he had two other rounds of a different treatment that almost killed him with the syphilis.
But that's not good.
When penicillin came out, he was actually a really perfect candidate to try it because they were like, we know you have it and we know you have late stages. So let's see what it can do.
I mean, they probably couldn't make it worse at that point is what they were probably thinking.
Exactly. And it didn't stop it. It didn't cure it. But it did slow it for a while.
If it bought him more time. Although then you wonder, okay, time for what though?
Right. To shit himself more.
Time to be in prison. Time to serve his time. I mean that.
But it was in February of 1938 that Al was formally diagnosed with neurosyphilis. And with that, May petitioned the warden to release Al. Not only because of good behavior, but because of his medical condition. And it wasn't immediate, but he was able to be released in November of 1939. He was released, of course, due to the good behavior, but also very much contingent on the medical condition of, like, you clearly are not a harm to anybody. Like, you're not a threat because you can't even use the bathroom on your own.
there's also a pessimistic side of me
mm-hmm.
that believes, though I don't know what the laws were at the time, but the government has a responsibility to pay the medical bills of those incarcerated. So if he was going to cost a whole hell of a lot more than they thought he was worth, and they had a quick way to see out of that,
correct,
then they could have just released him based on it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Which...
And not for nothing, but he didn't pay his taxes, so it wasn't his money going towards himself.
It's pretty disgusting how it can work like that, but yes, that wouldn't surprise me either.
Follow the money.
That's what I say.
But Al lived in his mansion in Florida with May, and he lived there for nearly a decade. Mind you, Al was still only 40 when he was released. He's a young man. But his life was not easy in that last decade, or almost. It was like 8 years, maybe, outside of prison that he lived.
How long did he serve?
I think when all is said and done after the court and everything, it was only like 4.5 years.
So not the full sentence he was supposed to get.
Certainly not. But hear me out. In 4.5 years...
He got medical care he probably wasn't going to seek otherwise.
He got medical care he wasn't going to seek otherwise. He learned how to play an instrument, so good for him.
Jeez.
But also, he deteriorated so fast mentally. I can't imagine what would have happened if he was out.
Yeah. If he were making decisions in the capacity that he had been.
Right. Or just how fast does another gang take a hit out on you if you don't even know where you are?
Yeah.
How fast do you kill your best friend because you start hallucinating and think that this is another person that you've killed in the past that's haunting you?
That's an awful way to go through life. I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
But it was this time period in his end of life that actually re-piqued my interest in the Capone case.
Hmm.
I had actually recently watched the movie Capone with Linda Cardellini, who I just love. See Dead to Me and Scooby-Doo.
But yes. Big fan.
Ugh, huge. Huge.
Huge.
But this film is an odd interpretation of his last 10 years. And fascinatingly enough, it made him out to seem a lot older than he was in reality. It was a very curious, but I think well done, like artful take on a mob boss slowly losing his mind and mental functioning. It was hard to watch, but it was really, in my opinion, I think realistic in terms of his capabilities near the end. While the movie portrayed his abilities as far more with it in the beginning, the reality was different. In real life, in his release in 1939, the doctors at Alcatraz estimated that Al had only the mental capacity of a 7-year-old. He was 40.
That is awful.
And it's awful when it happens to anyone, but it's so young. Like, he was incarcerated for 4.5 years. He went in a 30-something-year-old and came out with the capacity of a 7-year-old.
And this was preventable.
Correct. All he had to do was treat the fucking syphilis.
And he had the means and he had the opportunity. This wasn't a lack of either of those where you can see how that could happen. This was a choice.
Yep.
Ugh.
Al and May were allegedly supported by one of Al's brothers at the time, my guess is Ralph, despite rumors of stashes of money hidden anywhere and everywhere. Despite depictions of this rumor being in media and seemingly perpetuated even by Al's niece, who eventually wrote a book about Al, the mental deterioration meant any piece of truth to this was lost with him. And while there are still rumors of his treasure, they did at some point renovate the hotel he used to operate out of with all the tunnels and stuff in it, hoping they were going to find some of it.
Oh, how cool.
And they televised it. But it was just empty liquor bottles.
Mm.
So nothing green stashed there, you know?
Darn it.
Also, anytime people talk about treasure, it kind of makes me giggle. Like, I think about National Treasure, right? And they look at all of this priceless art and gold and things like that. But if we're talking about like 1920s treasure, it's just the same dollar bills, you know? So it's like with inflation, I got $20. Woo!
Yeah.
Not quite the same punch.
Yeah. And that alcohol is not as sought after or valuable as it correct. Is as it was then.
And not for nothing, I know whiskey's better aged, but I don't know that all alcohol is. So
yeah.
That being said, there is still hopes of a secret stash of money from Al somewhere, unfound. So if you're a treasure hunter, check into it.
And cut your girls in. Come on.
Yeah. So Al Capone lived, degrading in capacity and ability. And it was on January 21st, 1947, that Al Capone started to have seizures. But it wasn't until January 25th, 1947, that he died from heart failure at 48 years old. Likely a complication of the syphilis, neurosyphilis, strokes, and the strain on your body that that would take, on top of the sex and drugs and rock and roll that filled his younger years.
Jeez. That is so young.
48.
He looked older.
He looked older.
But he lived a rough life. I mean,
it was a long 48
years. He ran a gang at like 24.
Oh, he was the top of the crime world at 26. He, as a kid, was in gangs before he was out of the eighth grade. I don't even know that he made it to the eighth grade.
Yeah.
Al Capone is an infamous man. If you think of Chicago in the 20s, you probably think of Al Capone. If you think of Alcatraz, you might think about Al Capone. If you think about the Prohibition or the Mafia or even Chicago in the Depression, you probably think about Al Capone. He's become somewhat of a known mystery. He became famous, though ideally that would be infamy, due to his greed, gore, and violence that ran the city of Chicago for years. He even played a role in getting expiration dates on milk. He kidnapped a well-known jazz player for his fucking birthday, but then he sent him home with thousands of dollars in his pocket.
But you kidnapped him.
And he even opened food pantries that sustained people for years through the Great Depression. But he also killed hundreds of people. He ordered an estimated 300 hits, had been engaged in murder, if not murder for hire, before his 20s, ordered people to be beaten almost to death, blew up businesses and preyed on the owners for interest revenue and liquor revenue, bought majority holdings in corporations, threatened to and followed through on beating and using violence to intimidate voters into changing elections. He put innocent bystanders at risk with the constant shoot-ups and machine gun play, gave syphilis to like literally every brothel babe. And on top of this, put his wife and son through it all with him. Al is a wild man. I can't say I admire, appreciate, or commend Al Capone for anything. I find this story fascinating, and that's kind of the extent of the interest. I know I'm not alone. Al has inspired media for as long as people knew his name, from headlines in the day to movies like Capone or books, both fiction and nonfiction. I mean, hell, there are children's books called things like Al Capone Shines My Shoes or Al Capone Does My Shirts by Jennifer Childenko. Regardless of your spin or your story, Al Capone was a man with range. He was murderous or your fiercest ally. And that, well, that's a compliment, honey.
Holy shit.
That's Al Capone for you.
Well, thank you, honey. You see?
You see? Yeah, that's been a wild ride.
I could do, I think it would be really fascinating to do like a mafia series, but
ooh, yeah.
I gotta know if you guys are wanting that too, because that would, I mean, I'm gonna like do a deep dive and geek out with my popcorn and my blue light glasses on.
Yeah.
But I gotta know if you guys wanna like hear it. Mic's on or off, guys. This is pretty much what you gotta let us know.
Yes. So let us know you want to hear about all the mafia stuff. You want mafia intel from a real Italian?
Oh, yeah.
Because I've only just recently learned the Italian hand thing. So clearly I am honorary. So I can give you the number to this hot Italian I know who's like 3 feet tall.
Oh, yeah.
She's so cute.
That's so mean. I'm 5 feet tall, damn it.
Woo!
Ow, ow!
Add those inches on inches on inches.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what I have for you. Let us know if you liked it. Let us know what you think. Do you have any fun Al Capone stories or facts? Did he visit your diner in Illinois?
Did he?
Let me know.
That'd be pretty cool.
Also, if you're in Cicero and you know where his fucking headquarters were, let me know. It is lost in all of the everyone telling me everywhere he sat.
Yeah, can you guys like let us know?
Yeah.
Send us a cute little message or an email or whatever you, however you choose to reach out to us. We'll love it.
And if you wanted to not only partake in our little questionnaires on Instagram, but also see Al Capone, the people, the places, the things, everything we talk about, you can do that on our Instagram at About Time for True Crime Pod with periods in between every word. So that is ABOUT period TIME period FOR period TRUE period CRIME period POD because podcast was too long. But if you wanted to email us something longer, a case recommendation, a pod pet, your hopes and dreams, if you had a weird dream that had Al Capone in it and you thought, huh, they'd like to read that, you could email that to us. But Allie, where would they do that?
If you wanted to email us any of those things and more, you could do that to abouttime4tc@gmail.com. So that's ABOUTTIME4TC@gmail.com. We love you and we love to hear from you. We'd love to hear like your hometown or like what happened near you. What crimes, what's a case that got you into true crime? What's something that you want solved? What's one that you have a legitimate connection to? We'd love to be able to share those on the pod. So just let us know. And we love you and we love hearing from you. And if I take a gander.
Ooh. Would you look at that?
Clock. You're sweet. That was
About Time for True Crime.
Bye.
You're sweet.
Talk out for now, honey.